Good evening, everyone. If you can make it to your seats, we can get started. We have a lot to cover tonight. Wow. Thank you. So welcome to Calc 2013 and this evening's intriguing discussion. My name is Cheryl Hillier-Tucker, and I am a 1978 graduate of Arts and Science. I am currently an alumni elected trustee, and I am the chair of Mosaic. And I also enjoy being a member of the Cornell Alumni Magazine Board. So I'm a busy alum, and I enjoy it. And as much as I love all my Cornell affiliations, I must admit that Calc is one of my favorite events. So before we get started, I just wanted to ask, is everyone having a good time? All right. I want to thank everyone at Cornell, especially those in Alumni Affairs and Development, who work so hard each year to make Calc even better than the last. And I also want to thank the Cornell Entrepreneurial Network for helping put this event together. So if you want to give them an applause. In addition to the full house of Cornellians here tonight, we are also joined by alumni tuning in via live stream. So welcome to all of you as well. So before we get started, I want to do a little bit of housekeeping, because we always have to do that. And I would like to point out that we will not be taking live questions from the audience this evening to respect our time constraints. However, all of you have the opportunity to interact with the panel during our post-event reception that I hope you all will attend. And for those of you on Twitter and on our Twitter and live stream audience, we will select a few questions for the panel for you to submit using hashtag CornellCalc. Okay. So tonight I am honored to introduce our featured event, A Lively Conversation on Healthcare Today, Implications for Tomorrow. And as a journalist who has covered healthcare, I am really very interested in this conversation. We are in for an engaging discussion. These five remarkable Cornellians, who are all leaders in their field, will offer unique insights on some of the world's most essential topics as they relate to healthcare. And we have the ideal person to lead our discussion. So if you don't mind, I really would like to introduce this moderator properly. It's my pleasure to introduce our moderator this evening, Dr. Philip Riley. He's a class of 1969 graduate from the College of Arts and Science. Phil also holds an MD from Yale and a JD from Columbia. Phil is currently a trustee of Cornell, and he serves as chair for the College of Veterinary Medicine Advisory Council. He is a member of the Life Sciences Advisory Board. He chairs the Education Teaching Committee. Phil is also a Major Gifts Committee member. But besides all the work he does for Cornell, he also is a venture partner at Third Rock Ventures. And in this role, he supports the firm's founding and advancement of new ventures with a particular focus on seeking to nurture and grow transformational companies dedicated to breakthrough treatments for genetic disorders. Phil is an accomplished entrepreneur and has a long-standing interest in genetic testing and in developing new therapies for genetic diseases. He served twice as president of the American Society of Law, Medicine, and Ethics. He is a founding fellow of the American College of Medical Genetics, the author of six books.
Thank you very much.
I didn't even finish. He holds numerous teaching positions at Tufts University.
I'm not ready to announce my candidacy yet. You did a great job.
I'm going to finish. At Tufts University School of Medicine, Harvard Medical School, Cornell University, and has served as an adjunct professor of both legal studies and biology at Brandeis. And he's a member of the Massachusetts Bar and certified in internal medicine and clinical genetics.
Thank you.
So welcome, Phil.
Now, to be fair, I'm going to devote equal time to all four. Each one will get a quarter of my time for introductions. good evening, everyone. On behalf of the panel, we are delighted to chart a path of a conversation about healthcare in America today. We know that there are many of you out there that have as much to add to this discussion as we do. We wish you could be up here with us. Hopefully, we will enrich your evening tonight, and you'll have a lot of time to talk to each other about these issues. So we're limited, inevitably, as all humans are, by the constraints of the system. I'm going to make some very brief introductions, and then I have a few very brief remarks, and then we're going to turn and go right to the questions. So to my far right, a newer but very important member of the Cornell family, Dr. Lori Glimcher, who made the wise move to leave Boston and go to New York and become the dean of our wonderful medical school. I have the privilege of knowing her a little, and she's just a great addition, and we'll have many insights into tonight. So thank you for being here, Lori. Gene Resnick, to my right, another physician, is particularly able to contribute this evening. Gene has been a practicing internist, a practicing oncologist, and more recently in life, turned to the industry medical interface, looking at drug and medical device development and a world called the CRO world, which he may tell you a little bit about. To my left, another Cornellian, Dr. Katrina Furlick, a neurosurgeon, an author, and somebody who has changed course, I think it's fair to say, in her own career to become much more interested in the patient equation, if you will, how patients react to and deal with the guidance that physicians attempt to give them. And to my far left, another Cornell board member, Reuben Kingshaw, has been a notable investor in the healthcare arena for some time and thinks very deeply about where equity and healthcare dollars should go into making medicine a better place for all of us. So, forgiving me the brief introductions, let me just make an opening statement, if you will. As we talk tonight, I hope that you will keep two questions in mind. I think they are antipodal questions that guide some of these debates. And here's the first question I'd like you to think about. What sort of healthcare do you want for the people you love? And the second question is, what sort of healthcare do you want for strangers? And how are those two questions answered differently? Why do they have to be answered differently? So let's just keep that in mind. I also would like to make the obvious comment that the very difficult questions we're going to address this evening are not new. When I was a young guy, one of my heroes was Walter Cronkite. Some of you remember him, you're old enough. And more than 30 years ago, Walter Cronkite said on television, America's healthcare system is neither healthy nor caring nor a system. That was 30 years ago. One of the things we're asking tonight is whether Walter Cronkite's assertion is still true, or is it more true than ever? So having tried to set the stage for you with those brief remarks, I'm going to first turn to Dr. Lori Glimcher, who thinks very deeply about the overall status of healthcare research in America. And the way we're doing this is after I pose the question to one individual, I want anybody else on the podium here to feel free to join in. So Lori, with an eye to improving healthcare, what are the biggest challenges that you see that are faced by the research community in the, say, the coming decade?
Well, I think we're all very cognizant of the fiscal constraints. The biggest funder of healthcare research, of course, is the National Institutes of Health. And if you look at the funding from the NIH over the last decade, it's fallen about 20% from 2003 to 2013. And in real terms, that means that we're not funding our best and brightest scientists. And that I think we have the real possibility of losing our edge here. Now, and it's a real shame because we are actually in an era now where we can do what we call translational medicine, which means actually translating discoveries that we make in the laboratory into therapeutics to treat human disease. We couldn't say that a decade ago. We didn't have the tools, but now we have enormous tools, technological advances, the human genome sequence, what we call precision medicine. And we're ready and poised to make that transition, but we can't do it in the absence of adequate funding. So, you know, if sequestration goes into effect, we are going to see at worst an 8.2% cut in NIH funding, at best maybe about a 3.5% cut, which is very significant because that'll be our new baseline. So I'm very worried about the future of research funding in this country.
And would you say that acts particularly hard on the younger investigators?
Well, I think it discourages the young investigators. You know, they're looking at a career in science, and they see their mentors, their professors, grants getting tossed out, not getting funded. We have senior investigators who are leaving the field in droves, so these young people think, well, what am I doing? I mean, am I committing myself to a career that is not going to be sustainable? And then we have countries like China that are pouring in lots and lots of resources to funding biomedical research. So somehow we have to convince Congress that this is a priority. It's not only a priority for solving human health problems, but it's a priority for our economy.
Jean, your work, as I understand it now, brings you very close to thinking about new drugs, new devices, how these things get approved. One step perhaps from basic research and closer to translational medicine, as we call it. What kinds of obstacles do you see in the future? Are there regulatory problems you think we can streamline? How would you go about addressing some of the problems you confront?
Thanks. Thanks, Phil. Very impressive CV, by the way. I just wanted to...
I went to Cornell.
I think the forward-looking prospects for new drugs and new devices in this country and in the world, really, is actually pretty bright. There's going to be already starting a real focus on outcomes-derived and evidence-based research, both at the basic level and at the certainly at the clinical level, so that new treatments and new devices will not be approved unless they have real evidence of utility. I think that's important in a number of reasons, not only because of the good science that will be behind that, but because that will I think, address some of the issues about the health economics that we have in this country. Namely, we spend 60% more than most, everybody knows these statistics, 60% more than other developed countries. England, even despite the criticisms of the National Health Service, spends about 11% of their gross domestic product, but they have national health care. So that we are going to see, I think, less waste, less money spent on treatments that have actually little, if any, evidence to support their utility going forward. And that should help drive economies in the health system as we move to see new treatments. The last thing I would say on that question, Phil, is that it's actually a pretty exciting time in medicine. Laurie's mentioned, and you've been involved certainly in some of the genomic advances. We understand much better about how diseases work, how drugs and devices work, so that I think seeing these kinds of advances in personalized medicine, in targeted therapies, so that we know which patient will be most likely to have a therapeutic benefit is going to drive the system towards substantially more efficiency going forward.
So let me ask you a follow-up question since you alluded to England. You and I are a little bit familiar, at least, with a committee in England called NICE, a sort of felicitous name for the organization. This is essentially a gatekeeper for new drugs, something that we really don't have in the United States. Do you foresee in the future that kind of level of oversight where we might even see efficacy for a drug, but at a different level, an economic level, an agency for the government says, it's just not good enough. It's good, but it's just not good enough. It doesn't pass the economic test.
After the British equivalent of the FDA approves a drug for safety and efficacy, the NICE committee, which is National Institute for Health and Clinical Excellence, I think, reviews the drug for economic benefit, so that a cancer drug that prolongs life, and without any doubt prolongs life for a short period of time, is questionably approved by the NICE committee. And if it's not approved by the NICE committee, it's not reimbursed in the national health system. It's really a form of economic rationing. I ask the audience, do you think that the United States is ready for anything like that? We see there was a recent case in Memorial Sloan Kettering in New York for a cancer drug that's very high priced for a very small population of patients. The formulary there said we can't afford it at Memorial, and they negotiated pretty quickly with the manufacturer who reduced the price. So I think the hard answer is that yes, those kinds of decisions are coming. As a society, we need to come to grips with the fact I think we need to make those decisions, and it's been something that we have pretty carefully avoided so far.
Great, thanks. So let me turn to Katrina, Dr. Furlick. Katrina has had a very interesting, I think, career transition from the cold, bright lights of the operating room in neurosurgery to the hot, white lights of the podium for Cornell. But she is working on a new company that really focuses on patient behavior, integrating the patient in a more positive and dynamic way into the healthcare system. So let me ask you generally to speak on what took you there and why you are optimistic or not optimistic about using this approach to improve healthcare.
Well, first, I like to joke that I, after perfecting brain surgery, I wanted to take on a bigger challenge of actually getting people to follow doctor's orders, which is quite a challenge for many reasons. But what I'm optimistic about and what my company is focused on is the greater realization that it's not enough to have an effective drug. You actually need an effective patient. And it turns out that when drugs go through clinical trials, these trials are done at 100% compliance or near 100% compliance. There are measures in place to make sure people take them every day. And that's when you see that they're better than, say, placebo or better than a different drug. But out in the real world, the statistics are fairly staggering. Many drugs are never even picked up at the pharmacy, even the first prescription. These are for conditions like hypertension and other so-called silent diseases, but it's across the board. And the growing realization is that it's not enough to have a good drug. You need a good drug plus the idea of taking it enough. So my company is all focused on motivating patients to understand the value in the medication. And the underlying problem is that there's no short-term reward to taking your hypertension medication. It's all long-term reward. So there's this disconnect here. There's this idea that a doctor thinks if you give the medication to the patient, they'll know to take it, but often that's not the case. Compliance rates are anywhere from 50 to 70% for most chronic conditions, and that's just not high enough to actually allow for the outcomes we want.
So let me ask you a follow-up question. The Institute of Medicine, which has existed since 1970, is probably one of the nation's think tanks for our healthcare system, recently issued a new report called Best Care at Lowest Cost, The Path to Continuously Learning Healthcare in America. That is a system that grows and improves by making better use of information. So let me start with you, and others can certainly chime in that if they have opinions. What do you think about this notion? You think about data, that we can actually harness data, thinking about the whole universe of patients that we deal with in this world, from the most educated to the poorest people. Can we harness information to make this system work better for doctors and patients?
Yeah, I think so, and I think a big trend, which I'm very excited about, is the idea of personalized medicine, not only when it comes to picking the right drug, but picking the right support system or service to be wrapped around the drug or other forms of treatment. In other words, figuring out, does this patient need more education? Do they need a cost reduction? Do they need motivation? You know, what is it that the patient needs? And tailoring the approach to the right patient, and that requires data. That requires data on whether or not they are refilling their medication, data on how educated they are about their condition. And I think the idea of mining data and then tailoring the treatment to the right patient is a great trend.
Okay, let me go to Reuben Kingshaw, who has had a very impressive career in channeling, and we do live in a capitalist society, channeling dollars for innovation in healthcare, looking at young or early companies and making, on behalf of his investors, bets about what's going to happen. You think hard about the future of healthcare and where dollars should go to make things better. What does your crystal ball say for the future? And you know, any tips are welcome.
Well, Ruben's going to make a lot of money. He's going to be able to afford to send both his kids to Cornell. He has one right now. As I look at the healthcare economy through the prism of what we now call Obamacare or the Accountable Care Act, I mean, I think there's certain things that are evident. You know, what that piece of legislation did, and I'm highly critical of parts of it, but there are elements of it that I think are very predictive. One of the outcomes of the bill was to begin to change the way providers are reimbursed or paid. And so there's an opportunity to support companies that can better enable hospitals, physicians to manage under the new payment policy. And two of the key elements of that is that, you know, hospitals and physicians will be paid more based on outcomes. This notion of pay for performance, demonstrate that you can perform better against history or benchmark or your peers, and your reimbursement, your payment, should be higher than someone who did not perform quite as well. That does, mean it does imply better collection of data, comparative analytics. And so there's a investment window in the technologies, the companies, the strategies to better collect and aggregate and disseminate data, clinical outcomes, for the purpose of, you know, enhancing reimbursement or measuring value in the healthcare economy. I mean, the other big trend in payment policy is to promote home and community-based delivery of services, you know, so that there are superior clinical outcomes and economic outcomes, meaning savings. And so there's an opportunity to invest in delivery systems, companies, models that can take care of elders or children or those with long-term or chronic conditions, not in the institutionalized setting, but in their homes, in their communities, in ways that they are, you know, more comfortable and in many ways can be better patients. If there's a third one, I would say, and the combination of the service and the technology, is those internet strategies that can help patients make better decisions about their own care and remain engaged in the treatment plan over a longer period of time. The days when a patient will go to a physician and say, "Heal me, doctor," and abdicate all responsibility to know or do anything different, I think, are over. And so there are many tools, and the internet is one of them, that can help patients better understand their condition, participate in those decisions, comply with those decisions, make behavioral changes for superior outcomes clinically and again, financially.
Right. So let me, there are so many topics we can just barely touch on here. Let me ask all four of you a more general question, and that is, what would you say is the status of preventive medicine in the United States, maybe taken from a public health perspective, and anticipating that you're less than optimistic about the current state of things, what are the creative things we can do as a society to shift the focus more on keeping disease from happening in the first place? Lori, would you like to start?
Let me take a crack at that. I want to go back to the recently released report from the IOM that you referred to, showing that when compared to 16 other developed countries, Americans live shorter lives and have poorer health care. We're at the bottom of the list. Even though we spend almost 20% of our GDP on health care, which is far more than these other countries do.
Right.
And I think in the setting of preventive medicine, partly it's our personal behavior, right? We eat too much. We have a staggering rate of obesity in this country. We abuse drugs too often, and we don't always wear our seat belts. And there's an incredibly high level of violence at all age groups, particularly in the younger population. And we also have poor safety net programs. It's a lot less expensive to prevent disease than it is to treat it. And it's also a lot less expensive in the long run to find cures for diseases that we can't prevent by funding basic research than it is to, I mean, take Alzheimer's, for example. Alzheimer's disease is gonna, 5 years from now, cost us $1.2 trillion because of the aging of the population. If you think about it, the fastest growing demographic in this country are those over 85, and one out of two individuals over 85 is gonna have Alzheimer's disease. And that person's gonna require three health caregivers. We gotta figure out how to preferentially prevent this disease, or if not, at least to slow it. If we could even slow its onset by 5 years, it would have an enormous impact on our healthcare costs. And to do that, we gotta be funding the scientists who are trying to figure out why some people deposit tangles and plaques in their brains.
Oh. Would you like to make a comment?
65 million Americans live in an area that is underserved by primary care physicians. It's an extraordinary number. So that although our medical school turns out 101 terrific graduates every year, this country is facing a shortage not only of research scientists, which need to be attracted to the laboratory, but to physicians, to the basic bench, basically, to the family practitioner, to the internal medicine practice, so that those folks, those patients, those Americans can get adequate health care, which includes preventative care. It's an astounding statistic, and it's an area that's going to get only worse when the kinds of dilemmas of the aging population that Laurie talks about come true, and they will.
And it's magnified by the fact that our students, our medical students, don't really have a choice oftentimes. We have students who want to become primary care physicians, but they have $200,000 worth of debt from college and medical school, and they really can't do it because primary care is a low-paying specialty, and they say, well, no, we'll have to go into some specialty because we cannot pay back our debts. So
you remind me of a conversation I had with some medical students a couple years ago where they said, they were complaining actually about the interest rates on their loans, which are far higher in America today than what you pay on your mortgage if you get a new mortgage, which I find shameful, frankly. Mm-hmm. But they were saying to me, for a tiny fraction of the cost of healthcare in America, one said to me, if you could pay the medical tuition for everybody and build into the system 2 years of primary care in these areas, the return on that investment would be venture capital dream returns in terms of prevention.
I calculated how big an endowment while Cornell would need to have to make our medical college tuition free, and it's about $400 million endowment.
So it's just another issue about how dollars are allocated, if any of you want to write a check. That Laurie is accepting checks. Would either of you folks to my left have any comments into this conversation?
I mean, only to say that the leading driver of healthcare costs are not clinical, it's behavioral. You know, it's diet, it's exercise, it's decisions that people make, you know, every day to engage in, you know, healthier behavior in the broadest sense. And so, you know, I think that, you know, we can clearly invest in our clinical infrastructure, our professionals, our educators, and our scientists, and those are all the right things to do. But we will always be catching up. We'll never be leading the curve unless we invest the right amount of time at the right level of priority and the right amount of resources in working with the larger population to change the decisions we make about our bodies and our minds and the activities in which we engage. And so I think the return on prevention is huge, but the investment needs to go into areas where it typically has not gone, you know, which is behavioral change, cultural change, habit change, those kinds of things.
Something you're working on.
Yeah, I completely agree with Ruben. I think the goal really is to motivate patients to do things for themselves so they don't need the healthcare down the line. And that is the holy grail. How do you motivate behavior change? And I think we really do need to take cues from industries outside of medicine in terms of how to motivate people. This might sound crazy or somewhat crass, but my company is founded on a series of patents that largely came from Las Vegas. Las Vegas, they're experts in human psychology. Not for good, but we're using those insights to actually motivate people to change their health behaviors. You got to take knowledge from outside of healthcare and bring it into healthcare in ways that that motivate better change.
We also have to be sorry.
No, go ahead.
We also have to recognize that we're spending huge amounts of healthcare dollars in the last year of life. I mean, if you ask a physician, how would you like to die? Almost every physician would say, I'd like to die at home, in bed, peacefully, without massive interventions. And yet, that's not the case for many, many patients that we see. There's a sense, I think, in America that if the technology exists, you should use it. And there was just that report about the proton beam machine, which is very much more expensive than traditional radiation for cancer, and has been shown now to be no more effective. So just as pharmaceutical companies need to be making drugs that are not just me too's, right, that they need to be making drugs that are that meet unmet medical need and that are cover different chemical space. So I think we need to be very aware of how and when we use our most expensive facilities. And
Ruben talked about patients coming in or families coming in informed from the internet, cyberchondriacs in a way, but they come in knowing about these kind of scans,
right,
or knowing about tests, and overrule the physician by asking and demanding these kind of tests, and it drives the system to excess waste. I think you're absolutely right.
Because you get, well, then you get accused of, you know, death panels. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I ask you, how kind, how merciful is it to take an 86-year-old woman who with dementia and subject her to an aortic valve replacement? And that gets done in our hospitals. That gets done in our hospitals.
But maybe it's not so much, and this does not contradict you, I don't think, it's not so much the job of the system to say no, but back to education, as you were suggesting, for people to be understand what the limits of medicine are. Whether we can get there, I don't know, but it's a good thought. Let me ask another question that keys off of some of the earlier discussion. And I'm going to do this a little differently. I'm first going to pose the question to the audience, so you'll be thinking about your answers before I ask Ruben, I think, to lead this off with his answer. So I'm going to ask you all to think very creatively. We all agree there's a problem. It's a pretty serious problem. It's a problem of inefficiency and lack of education about healthcare. Inefficiency in the system and lack of education among many Americans about how to maintain a healthy life. So thinking about our society at large, what kind of truly innovative partnerships at the, you know, at the largest level of society could we begin to engage in to try and drive notions of healthy lifestyle and prevention forward from the get-go? So I look to Ruben first. If he'd rather have me turn to my right, I'll do that, or I'll start.
You know, I guess I'll throw out some concepts. You know, I think the best partnership is between a physician and a patient, between a caregiver and an individual. And I think if we could truly deliver, you know, evidence and research and budget and technology, and put them in the hands of that combination, not just when they are sick, but early in life, when that relationship can make a critical difference in the out years, the path, that would be innovative. It's not complicated in a sense, but we've never really done that. I mean, we've empowered one or the other, and there are all these mechanisms and insurance companies and banks that get in the way of that relationship. But I think the most innovative, the most powerful relationship or partnership, if you will, would be between, you know, an individual and a lead caregiver that would truly, intimately, profoundly design the entire, I don't know, multi-year, if not lifelong, relationship toward health in every facet. You know, for an example, there are individuals that have very strong faith identities of whatever the tradition, you know, might be. It is almost never an organized part of someone's care plan. And yet, for those people who have a profound, powerful faith, that is an intimate part of how they see themselves and how they motivate themselves and the curing process. That only comes into play when an individual puts it on the table and it is embraced by a caregiver in a system that can build it. And so now you're starting to add to that community. I'll stop when I say, you know, often we hear the old adage, it takes a village. And I think healthcare villages start with a patient and a caregiver, and we can add to that village all kinds of resources if we flex the system to empower that partnership to do what it does best, which is heal.
I think infiltrating the community with healthcare workers, not just physicians, but physician extenders. I was just in Haiti visiting while Cornell's Jeskio site,
yeah.
which was founded in 1982 by Bill Popp and Warren Johnson to deal with the HIV/AIDS epidemic. I was back there to visit it, and now they have an absolute epidemic of tuberculosis. And what they've done in the slums in Port-au-Prince surrounding the Jeskio site is to send out many, many field workers who go to every single shack in those slums and do a census of who's in that house. And anybody who has a cough immediately gets a sputum sample taken and a diagnosis of TB or not made. So these field care workers have really densely infiltrated the entire village and are getting these people to come to clinic and be treated. Now, we're obviously in a somewhat different situation here, but I think we need to also infiltrate the community. And to train our medical students for what's coming, which is that you got to work as teams of physicians, and teams of physicians and physician extenders. A group of our students founded this wonderful initiative called Heart to Heart, and they go out into the churches and the local communities, and they hold health screening sessions, you know, once a week or twice a week, and members of the community come in, and they get their blood pressure taken, they get a quick physical exam, they get bloods drawn, and so that the diagnosis can be made immediately. Yes, you have high blood pressure, yes, your cholesterol's too high, and appropriate care is then recommended for them. We need to do that 100-fold more than we're doing that now.
I'm glad you mentioned that program. The Medical School Alumni Association helped fund part of that. So we're very proud of it.
They did. Yes, they did indeed.
You know, at a similar level that we're seeing, actually for the first time in pharmaceutical and device development, collaborations among companies, which was really unheard of previously. There's a nonprofit that's been founded by 10 of the biggest pharmaceuticals in the United States called Transcelerate, which is a way for scientists at those companies to exchange ideas and to accelerate the early development practice. I think you know about some of those initiatives.
Yep.
And I think those kinds of initiatives we'll see throughout the healthcare system to try to accelerate advances and to bring information across boundaries, which previously were really quite siloed.
Yeah, and I'd like to add, I think mobile technology, I think, holds a lot of promise for what is sometimes termed automated hovering. I mean, I think the doctor-patient relationship is key, but there are many patients that spend only, say, a total of 3 hours a year with their doctor. So even if that's an intense 3 hours, what do you do about the rest of those thousands of hours during the year? And I think in addition to physician extenders in the community, mobile technology, internet can actually enhance the connection to healthcare when there's not a doctor or a nurse or some other form of extender in your presence.
Well, and I think we're working on a project right now that incorporates everything that my fellow panelists have talked about. We did a study and we looked at what's called food deserts. These are areas often in inner cities where the presence of groceries, quality grocery, is just not there. And health deserts where there's not adequate, you know, primary care or healthcare caregivers of any kind. And we found that there is an extraordinary overlap between these food deserts and health deserts. So we're working on a project using, you know, private equity resources to build, establish, move, buy urban grocery stores, for example, and place within those stores health coaches, clinics, physicians, nurses, health educators, because what we have found is that, A, there's a huge overlap between Medicaid and Medicare recipients and WIC or food stamp recipients, and a lot of the diseases that are prevalent in these or conditions that are prevalent in these communities are diabetes and hypertension, where the interaction of diet and medicine and health education can make all the difference in the world. Now, that's a partnership that's been tried in the pretty suburbs because Walmart does it, right? It's not been a model that has been effectively tried in urban settings because it was deemed that it wouldn't make economic or commercial sense. We believe that it does. And if we can do this, then we're looking at a urban, frankly, underserved, depressed economic area to do this. If we can do it well and find the right partnerships that would include technology and the faith community and et cetera, then that's a model that we can replicate nationally.
So I want to come back to the question I posed to the audience and push a little harder here. I'm going to ask two probably Pollyannish questions. I'll start again with you, Ruben, because you might be closer.
Am I the guinea pig?
So many corporations have a set of values that they publish, that they try to live by, they embrace. Why couldn't we challenge the Fortune 500 to make wellness a tenet of the very existence of the hundreds of thousands, millions of individuals that operate within that system? We have things like flexible healthcare accounts. Why couldn't we ask corporate America to really step up to prevention at the level of, say, 21 to 65? Is it possible to get the CEOs in this room and get them to agree to that? Not so much dollars, but attitude. Time off work for, I know much of that exists already, for wellness programs. You think, is that completely unrealistic?
No, I mean, there's a new generation of healthcare products called total health management, and we're invested in that too, full disclosure. And the concept is that employers are increasingly understanding the interaction between mental health and stress conditions and work environment and healthcare. And so I think you do see an evolving consciousness and awareness among employers to make this commitment to wellness and prevention and outcomes and a total health, total lifestyle improvement, which includes prevention strategy. I think it will always come secondary to the job that they're given by their shareholders, which is to return a profit, to build a product and distribute it and hit your numbers. And so I think that the danger is in a booming economy or when labor is tight, there are economic incentives for employers to make a big deal out of this because they have the extra profits or they're competing for labor to come work for them. In economies like this one, that will fall to a much lower priority because they're fighting for market share. And so there's a tension there that I think we'll always have to deal with.
Okay, so let me take another version of that question and hand it to you, Katrina. So here's the way I'm going to put it. As physicians and just citizens, we know that the vast majority of healthcare expenditures focus on actually a handful of healthcare problems. I'm going to pick diabetes. You are thinking a lot about diabetes, but I want to take it in a slightly different direction. Can we, if we think grandly, imagine a partnership with schools so we attack this issue, this explosion of juvenile obesity and a trajectory towards diabetes? In fact, we don't even call it adult onset diabetes anymore because it's childhood onset. A name of a journal was recently changed to affect that. Can we build compliance into school system programs in a way that our society will accept?
Well, I think, when you're talking about behavior change and compliance, it's across so many different behaviors. And with diabetes, it's the obvious. It's the nutrition, it's the exercise. If you're on a medication, it's taking the medication. And so I think wherever in society you can motivate people and get them to understand the value of prevention and treatment, whether it's the schools, whether it's at work, I think those partnerships are going to be where you'll be able to get beyond just the doctor-patient relationship, but actually pervade people's everyday lives.
So Connecticut, where you're based, is a pretty wealthy and pretty progressive state. Could you imagine the State Department of Public Health and the State Department of Education getting together and saying, we're going to go a lot further than eliminating, big cans of soda from the cafeteria. We're going to take this seriously. We're going to build health education from kindergarten to age 18 as meaningful a part of the curriculum as mathematics.
Well, it sounds like a dream, a dream scenario.
We're here to dream.
Yeah, it sounds like a dream scenario. I would be all for that. As to how to get it done, I don't have any brilliant ideas.
They're going to help us. So.
But I think that's that's what we're talking about in terms of it has to go beyond just traditional medicine.
Yeah. I just wanted to come back to your innovation question and make a comment about the relationship between academic medical centers and the private sector and how important I think that is. The Bayh-Dole Act of 1984 gave IP, intellectual property, back to the universities on the condition that they use taxpayers' money that they had funded their research to translate the discoveries from bench to bedside. And I think we're at the point now where doing that most effectively requires partnership between academic medical centers and pharmaceutical companies. Because we in academia are best at what we call the research part of research and development, and the pharmaceutical companies are often better at the development part. And by teaming up, we not only are economically savvy by teaming up, but we can get drugs from the laboratory into patients more quickly. And I bring this up because there's this perception, I think there's still this perception that scientists and academia should not dirty their hands by working with industry, and that is an idea whose time is long gone.
Certainly is. We've gotten some great questions from our extended audience, and I think I'd like to turn to a few of them. Maybe, Gene, I'll ask you to take a first crack at this one. I think I'm right. I could have my number wrong, but I think the Affordable Care Act made up to $18 billion available for conversion to electronic medical records.
All right.
So the question is, will the electronic medical records industry improve efficiency and or assist with data mining, and how much of a difference might that make?
Well, I think the number is a little higher. I think it was 20 or 21 okay. billion, a billion in that act, with incentives to physicians and hospitals and practices to convert and use EMR, electronic medical records. You may have seen in the Times, New York Times, a week or two ago, a study from the RAND Corporation citing the dismal disappointment of the conversion to electronic medical records so far. I think the report was accurate, but was premature, because I think these things take a while to see the benefits filter through the system. There's no question when a middle-aged or elderly person with seven or eight medications is treated by a physician using electronic medical records with the software that corrects for drug interactions, that we're going to see a reduction in medication errors and savings in the healthcare system. I don't think there's any question about it. I think as we measure these things, it takes time to see the benefits. I think it's money well spent. There's been quite a few companies that have been that started on electronic medical records that have had some, technology difficulties. But I think those vendors that are in the marketplace now actually are providing a great service, and we just need to have some patience.
And there's a recent study just published from Weill Cornell faculty Renu Kaushal and Lisa Kern that show that medical electronic health records are associated with higher quality care. I mean, we spend $17 billion a year solely from medical errors, which is not good for our patients and not good for our economy. The only way we're going to be able to mobilize the vast amounts of data we need to really be able to deliver what we call precision medicine is to have these enormous databases, and you can't do that without electronic health records.
It's the second part of your question related to data mining, and I think once the issues of privacy and so forth are dealt with, there's great opportunities in understanding trends in epidemiology, trends in demographics, and how those relate to changes in treatments and diseases.
And here I would just interject that a part of that still in the future, I think, is the use of genetic information to help refine approaches to therapy. For example, we're starting to see for the first time the DNA from tumors, solid tumors, being sequenced to look for specific drug interactions or drug choices that might not otherwise be obvious. So in a way, we're moving from a 19th or early 20th century organ-based cancer to a more DNA-based view of cancer may hold a lot of promise, and that's a kind of data mining. Either of you want to chime in on this?
Two senses, I think. In addition to all the obvious benefits, you know, in the instance of the care being delivered between a patient and a physician, I think part of what EMR does is it begins to enable a real system, a healthcare system, to work. Because many times patients have more than one condition, and so they have lots and lots of caregivers. What EMRs enable is for all the care community to operate on a common platform so they can see what their peers are doing and colleagues are doing. And eventually it won't just be physicians, but it'll be nutritionists, and it'll be health coaches, and it'll be lots of other people who are interacting on this platform. The outcomes can only get better when the system gets more integrated. And in many ways, our system has disintegrated. EMRs, I think, is probably the best hope we have of truly implementing a system where patient and people and providers can work across the silo for the better outcome of the entire community.
In central Pennsylvania, there's a healthcare system some of you may know called the Geisinger Healthcare System, which was a very early adopter of the EMR. And in that group of 600,000 patients, there are very good data that they've been able to really improve outcomes and actually significantly lower costs. That's a system that runs, it's not a for-profit operation, but runs with a very positive cash flow. This is a question that I hear a lot from different folks, so thank you to the person who submitted it. Some say that a big reason for our medical costs being so high is because of the risks of malpractice, the costs of the insurance, and the need to be defensive in a litigious society. Do you, the panelists, feel that that is true, and that to what degree, if so, is it a driver of misuse of healthcare dollars?
Yeah.
Oh. You want to start?
Go ahead. Oh, I mean, as a from my
You probably had pretty good insurance premiums.
I did.
Neurosurgeon.
During my neurosurgery practice, I had never been sued, but yet still had to pay about $120,000 a year, which was, money that I had to make. It wasn't paid for by a hospital, just to cover that. And obviously, it would have gone up tremendously if I had been sued. I don't think it's the number one problem in healthcare. Obviously, there are much bigger problems than this, but it definitely does weigh in the mind of doctors, and particularly specialists like neurosurgeons and OBGYNs. And definitely, if you're on the edge about whether or not to get a scan, you'll get a scan. That's at least experience between myself and colleagues. And the idea of not wanting to miss something is a pretty strong motivator.
Any other?
We're challenged as a society to decide between bad outcomes and bad practice. And they're not always the same. The very best practitioner in the very best institution can do their very best and have a bad outcome. And those outcomes wind up, unfortunately, in our legal system. It's something through tort reform, and becomes a very political issue, but those are the topics that we have to start to address as a nation, really.
True not only for healthcare delivery, but also for drugs. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a risk-benefit ratio, and you take a drug or you have an operation knowing that there's some risk. And as you said, Jean, sometimes those outcomes are not good for no reason that is litigious, but we're a very litigious society.
So this next question is a little bit different, but I think it introduces a new thought or expands the thought we discussed about earlier, and it's really about nutrition and the role of nutritional education in our society and in healthcare. And it says, what will the role of educational services that educate on nutrition be in medicine? How can nutrition and healthcare better collaborate?
I'll date myself by reminding the audience that I graduated from it wasn't called Weill Cornell then, but from Weill Cornell, 1974. And I think we had one, maybe 2 days of nutrition education. I'm going to ask the dean if that's changed. I certainly hope so.
Well, we are in the midst of revising our curriculum. And one of the new courses is actually a course funded by the Atkins Foundation on metabolic disease and the prevention of metabolic disease, which is obesity, diabetes, cardiovascular disease. And nutrition is a significant component of that. When I went to medical school, I didn't hear a word about nutrition.
Mm-hmm. It's a great place, though, for the interface of technology and public and medicine.
And let's give a shout out to the Cornell New York City Tech campus here, because one of the hubs of that campus is going to be the hub for healthy living. And the further to Katrina's point, the first faculty member hired is Deborah Estrin, who's a wonderful healthcare informatician whose research is focused on mobile devices. And I heard her talk recently, and she was describing a device that could monitor your blood sugar at all times and send that information directly to your physician, could monitor the number of minutes that you actually were exercising as opposed to what you said you were doing, what you were eating, and so forth. And I think that's going to be the way that the healthcare system can reach its fingers out, its tentacles out, to encompass a community.
So we're near the end of our allotted time. The hour goes fast. And I have a closing question to ask all of you, for you to answer among yourselves. We could talk about it during the reception. And then to ask each one of our panelists to address. Answer any way you want. So I'll begin to my left and go back to Lori. Ruben, if I'm going to empower you all. You have unlimited power to do good. So don't tell me it can't be done. Just tell me what you would do. If you could do one thing to improve healthcare in America, what would it be?
One thing. I would...
to teach people Zen breathing.
One thing. I think I lost my mic.
It's back.
I think it would be to find a way that every legal age adult has a sense of accountability and ownership for their own healthcare outcomes with some tangible repercussions and implications for failing to do that.
So that's, I think, a great statement about personal responsibility.
Yes.
Yeah, that's...
But real. I mean, you can't abuse your body for 40 years and then walk into a hospital and say, heal me at your expense, because I neglected to do it for 40 years. At some point, those chickens have to come home to roost. There's got to be some implications, repercussions for failing to live up to what I think is a personal responsibility to maintain the body that you were born with to the best of your ability.
Okay. Dr. Furlick?
I was going to make a similar comment, so I will change my idea. I think we have to make sure that the best and brightest of our students go into science and medicine. I think, you know, in our society where the Academy Awards trumps the Nobel Prizes in terms of people's interest, I think somehow, I don't know how, we've got to pique people's curiosity and interest in science and medicine. And I think not enough is done to keep that passion going past the elementary high school ages.
Great. So a responsibility argument, a knowledge argument.
Bill, I would drive the system to become very fully evidence-based, so that our patients, ourselves, our families, our practitioners were providing treatments that were based in known and understood outcomes, and that the frivolous treatment, the extra treatments, the wasteful treatments would slowly disappear. It takes a long time, I think, for us to get to that point. We're moving in that direction. But if I was so empowered, I would plop that onto the system pretty quickly.
I would break down the silos between our scientists and our clinicians, because I think we need to go not only bench to bedside, but bedside back to bench. And that can only be done if scientists are talking to physicians and physicians are talking to scientists. So I'm, you know, sort of rooting for discovery as well. We have got to keep discovery and biomedical research a top priority in this country.
So the moderator's job is to make the panelists look good and to end on time. And I've done both, so thank you very much. Thank you. We'll see you all at the reception, right? That's next.
What a thought-provoking panel discussion, and it's one that gave us all some responsibility in such a thorny problem. Thank you to Phil and to our panelists, Dean Glimcher, Katrina, Ruben, and Jean, and thank all of you for attending and everyone who attended via live stream. Let's all go into the foyer and join the panelists for our reception. Thank you.